each other pain. How we take each other's love without thinking anymore. Forgetting to give back is a need of pity.
Billy Preston.
Some things take so long, but how do I explain when not too many people can see we're all the same? Can't afford to see the beauty that surrounds them. Isn't it a pity?
And Paul McCartney with Isn't It a Pity from George Harrison, who we will celebrate is unfortunately dead, but in 1 month we're gonna celebrate next month his birthday, the 25th of February. Isn't it a pity if people wouldn't listen to this show tonight, to the Bold Scientist Under Shower? Today I have a guest, but it's mainly a colleague, but it's mainly a friend. Leonardo, absolutely. Hi Leonardo.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Fantastically.
Okay.
Looking forward.
Hi Leonardo. Leonardo is, as I was saying, an ex-colleague, mostly a friend of mine. I contacted to participate tonight's show, and as I wrote on Facebook in order to advertise the show, we're gonna talk tonight about what people do not think scientists are, namely how creative, how crazy, how interdisciplinary, someone would say transversal, probably is a too strictly translated Italian word, but I mean how everywhere and nowhere probably. Absolutely.
How irrational, how afraid.
Yeah, exactly. How human.
Absolutely.
People think that general audience just think that we are kind of robots, some sort of Terminator.
Nothing more distant from the truth.
Exactly. So Leonardo Celliani is with us. And who are you, Leonardo? So tell us something about your background, whatever, whatever comes up to your mind. And I mean, if I have some curiosity, I will stop you there and ask you something.
Ah, we have 2 hours. Oh, that's great. No, I'm kind of a strange animal in the sense that, I mean, professionally speaking, because I come from a totally different background. I was not a scientist until something like, I don't know, 15 years ago, something like that. Because I started by studying philosophy.
Oh.
In Torino. Yeah. And of course, the question is, how come a person who starts with philosophy goes into neuroimaging, brain imaging, or neurophysiology, stuff like that?
Ah, because I forgot, yeah, I mean, to tell you, because, so we are ex-colleagues, so as you perfectly know, I am a neuroscientist, so of course.
Sure, absolutely.
Also Leonardo is...
Yes, exactly. We're both neuroscientists. We work together at the Netherlands Institute of Neuroscience.
I used to, now I'm in Maastricht.
Yeah, now you're in Maastricht, exactly.
And so, yeah, indeed. So what is this? This is a bit the first insight on the craziness of a scientist. So how comes that a a student in philosophy?
Yeah, that's a very cute anecdote, actually, because I was in my second year of philosophy. And I was giving an exam that was in theoretical philosophy with a relatively young professor at the time, whose name is Maurizio Ferraris. And I was being examined on two texts.
Which, by the way, now is, I mean...
Oh, yeah, now he's a really, really great philosopher. He's probably one of the most well-known philosophers in Italy. And we were talking about the book on the soul by Aristotle. And I studied perfectly everything as is usual to me, obsessively, except 2 pages. And basically, the professor asked me to comment a sentence in those 2 pages. And the sentence was very interesting, was very complex, because it was talking about perception. And it was saying the point is something that we perceive as the absence. And he was asking me to comment this sentence.
So the point, you mean really a point.
The point. This is what Aristotle was writing. The point. He was talking about perception of different geometrical shapes. And then he was talking about the perception of the point. The point we perceive as the absence. I didn't absolutely have any idea about what to say. And of course, there I had something like 30 seconds. I had to invent something and say, okay, I am out of rational choices. I would have to go for something totally rational. And I remember the few concepts from high school about traditional geometry. And I remember that basically, according to Aristotle, perception occurred because something was actually impacting mechanically your organs of senses. And, you know, in order to impact your organs of senses, it needs to be a real object with real dimensions. And I remember that basically the point in geometry is the only geometrical figure which has no dimensions. And so basically my answer was, we perceive it as the absence because the point has no dimension. Therefore, we can only perceive it as the absence of something, absence of a dimension. Well, the point is that he liked very much the answer, incredibly. So I was encouraged by this to ask him whether I could do the thesis with him. And for some reason in that period, he was very interested in something that was called philosophy of perception. Now I don't remember anything anymore. But it turned out that because of that, I went to medicine to study neuroanatomy, neurophysiology. And I loved it so much that basically after that, I studied neuropsychology, clinical neuropsychology, and other disciplines. And the rest is history. Basically, I made a thesis that was combining cognitive psychology and philosophy. And then I went on and did a PhD in cognitive science with Maurizio Tirassa and Katiusha Sacco in Torino. And then by another series of interesting events, I ended up in Netherlands working with Christian Kaisers and Maria Gazzola in Groningen.
Yeah, we had them, now 1 year ago,
okay.
Guest. And this really, actually, now that you were talking, and actually we're going to talk a bit more in depth about that. It's interesting how a philosopher back then, thousands of years ago, were interested in perception. So something that now neuroscientists or,
absolutely. For some reason, I think it's quite natural because philosophers have always been interested in understanding the nature of the things and also the nature of man and also how knowledge works, how perception works, how emotion works, how reasoning works. And there have been so many theories. Actually, it was my favorite topic of interest when I was studying philosophy.
So back then, the neuroscientists were philosophers, actually.
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely, yes. Actually, it's interesting to see there is a very important writing in the history of psychology, which is The Principles of Psychology of William James from 1890, which would need a story apart because it's a very, very interesting story. The first real enormous text about psychology in a brain-related term, so to say. And yeah, basically what I want to say about the principles of psychology. Oh yeah, it's interesting. This is 1890 and still there are lots of references to Aristotle and to scientists from the 18th century, which is something that nowadays would not be considered acceptable. I mean, right now, if you cite something which is 5 years old, it's considered really old.
That's true, actually.
It's interesting. I mean, in 1890, there were references to Aristotle. I don't know how it happened, actually, how it changed, but...
For some reason, if you actually went to neuroscience based on Aristotle.
So probably yes. But it was actually mostly the love about the brain. I mean, when I discovered neuroanatomy, I was absolutely fascinated and I just wanted to go on with that.
But then we're going to talk about that more in depth later. So as I always ask to my guest, was being a scientist, neuroscientist, really your dream when you were a child?
Absolutely not. I never knew exactly what to do, but not because I had no interest, but because I had too many interests. I still have too many interests, and that's actually something.
So as many. So this is a bit. Yeah. So we didn't talk, so we didn't organize that. So it's a bit of a surprise for you.
Oh, thank you.
So many interests that we actually got to know that you wake up very early in the morning.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I wake up.
Is it true, Leonardo?
Absolutely. I wake up at 5.
Single day.
It's something which is very puzzling for most of the people. I do not understand why. It's such a fantastic moment of the day. It's very quiet. You can take your time to prepare for the day. Nobody runs after you.
So poor your girlfriend. No.
She sleeps on in the bed.
Okay,
I wake up.
Okay.
I wake up. I come to the kitchen. I prepare the coffee. But okay. Yeah, I wake up very, very early. And definitely the most productive hours are in the morning, and especially in the early morning.
No, it's true. I mean, the rare time I had to wake up early early in the morning, I really appreciate it. It's a very beautiful, also the light, as
absolutely.
You were saying.
Yeah.
Good. So this was a little
yeah, no problem.
unplanned. But so if you didn't have any childhood dream, do you have a adulthood dream?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah?
I guess it's about science.
No, absolutely not.
Science
is extremely interesting, but doing science the whole life, I mean, you need to have a special, I don't know, call to do that. I think that there are many, many things which are interesting, and science is something that you can do for a part of life. No, my dream, mine and my girlfriend, Katerina, is that at some point we want to open a dog shelter in Crete.
Oh, why a dog shelter? Why in Crete?
Well, first, because we absolutely love dogs and animals in general. And second, we have two animals, both of them rescued. In Crete, because it's a wonderful place, both in terms of climate, in terms of food, and also because there is already a friend of ours, Takis, who has a famous shelter in Greece. And we absolutely love what he's doing. So... We think that it's a beautiful life. I mean, continuously with dogs barking around, but for some reason we think that it's a very beautiful life.
I don't know, absolutely. Actually, for the one that are listening, Takis, I guess, has this dog shelter and ask for
yes,
offers,
actually. Yeah, he has a promotion right now. He just put out some t-shirts. Of course, everything to support. It's a totally non-profit organization. Everything to support the construction of other parts of the shelter.
Good.
So if you just Facebook Takis shelter, you will find it and you can have this fantastic t-shirt.
Great. Thank you, shelter, for, I mean, the sake of
thank you.
Good life of dogs.
Thank
so,
you
but
much.
Then, so So you were just saying before, yeah, how can you live all your life for science? Actually, it's a bit of a paradox because, so it's true, but it's a bit of a paradox because indeed the scientist is someone who is very curious. So it's actually normal that he's not necessarily only focused on science because it's actually more normal your way of looking at life because it's so scientist for nature has to be a curious person. So it's normal that he's also interested in other fields.
I do think so. I mean, actually, most of the scientists that I get to know had also completely unpredictable interest either in climbing or in doing music, and they were absolutely great at that. In, I don't know, winemaking. usually, you don't get to know these things because you only see the surface. Again, the main topic of our broadcast is the human behind the scientist.
Yeah.
And usually, you don't get to see these things, but definitely, usually a scientist, and not only a scientist, is a person with many interests.
So many interests that, I mean, of course, you are a great example of that, because as I wrote on the Facebook advertise on this broadcast, you're a fine musician. And that's what we're gonna follow up with, because we're gonna listen to a song written by Leonardo. What's the title, actually? I'm a bit unprepared.
The Elephant's Heaven.
The Elephant's Heaven.
Yes.
And
performed also by my ex-band, which is now in Paris.
What's the name of the band?
Lisa. But it is not there anymore, unfortunately, because I had to leave Paris. But
I
want to remember them because they were absolutely great musicians and friends.
Okay, so Lisa with Elephant
Heaven.
Heaven. The end. The end sounded like Guns N' Roses. Meow! This distortion.
This was Jeff, who was a fantastic guitarist.
Great song, man. Congrats.
It's just me. I mean, there is Jeff, Julien at the bass, and Igor at the drum, and they were great friends and great musicians. Definitely.
Cool. They were also very well recorded. Although, I mean, you were just saying.
It was just studio version with a professional recorder, but in the middle of the studio. So it was actually quite cool that it came out decently like that.
I know that you have always thousands of stories. So can you make it in 2 minutes? About the because you wrote this song.
Yeah, absolutely. So Elephant 7, it's really the song that I love most because it is attached to a very specific episode. I was living in Paris in that time, and there was a girl that I liked very much. It was a long time ago, but unfortunately she was already busy. And one evening,
what do you mean busy?
She was busy with somebody else.
Okay.
And one evening I was extremely angry about the situation. I really didn't know what to do because I was really, I was really taken by this person. And so I basically was wandering in the streets of Paris, smoking like crazy and completely angry. And then at some point around 3 o'clock in the morning, I came back home. And I just checked the internet before going to sleep. And by chance, on Facebook, there was a video of a very beautiful video in which there were two Brazilian musicians. Unfortunately, I don't remember the name right now. And with a homemade video, and they were singing a very cute song in Portuguese. He was playing the guitar and singing. She was playing the flute. And they had also their newborn kid on the chest of the lady. It was so beautiful and so sweet. I listened to it for something like 10 times. And after that, at some point, I just got the inspiration all of a sudden to write this song. I started to write it. I wrote it in something like 10 minutes. And it just came out like that. And the day after, I came up with the melody. And then a few days later, I proposed it to our guitarist and it started to grow. But it's amazing how from a situation in which I was totally angry, I wanted to break the world, this song changed completely my mood, and I don't know, it just made me dream and gave me the inspiration for this song, which is actually dedicated to a kid, because it's a song for a kid. It's a song that talks about life of a kid and the experience that he will have in his own life. Okay. And the Elephant 7 is an image that I had thinking about the big clouds in the sky. You say, okay, when the elephants die, where do they go? They go in the sky, and that's the heaven. So the big clouds are just like big heavens that keep on walking slowly one after the other.
wow, great.
Okay.
Yeah, I would like to continue talking about those elephants and those clouds, but we have to go back to work, man.
Sure.
So what interested me really about you was this curiosity and this diversity in what you do and what you have done also in science, because actually scientists are not those cold, dry machines that perform experiments.
Absolutely.
What they are actually? What is your experience? What do you think?
There is a very, very beautiful little clip on YouTube about from Richard Feynman, who was one of the finest physicists of the 20th century, and he was also a great communicator and a great teacher apparently. And basically, he's talking to an audience, a general audience, and say, "Okay, I want to tell you how scientists work, how we do our work." First thing, we guess an hypothesis. And of course, people start to laugh. What do you mean you guess? Yeah, no, we guess it. We really just guess it. We make an educated guess, but it's still a guess. Then we make an experiment. And then we look at the results. And if the results of the experiments do not go together with the hypothesis is wrong. Doesn't matter if the person who made it is very important or very beautiful. It's just wrong. And usually people focus on the second part of this tale, on the fact that scientists have to make a lot of work, a lot of calculations, a lot of experiments, and so on and so forth. And they don't think about the first part. How do we actually come to the idea of doing something? Because it's quite a great part. It's quite a big part of the scientific work, actually, to come up with ideas. That's not easy.
And so coming up with this idea, so you call it educated guess. So it's a, what do you think is a complete mechanic, rational guess, or there is something more?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I mean, many parts of this come just from trying to be creative, sometimes from irrational thoughts, sometimes just from curiosity. There is an event in the history of science which is very famous about the discovery of penicillin by Fleming in the 1928. What happened basically was that he had prepared some cultures of bacteria. He was studying Staphylococcus. And he put all his cultivation on the bench, and then he went on vacation. And he came back 2 weeks or 1 month later, something like that. And in all the cultivation that he did, basically the bacteria was growing, except one. Now, if he would have just reasoned in a very rational way, say, well, maybe here something went wrong.
So wait, let me understand. So
yeah,
mostly all of the cultivation, on all the cultivation, the bacteria was growing.
Except
in one where the bacteria was stopped.
Was dying. Absolutely. In this single one, the bacteria was dying. So what do you do now? Well, you can say, well, it's just I did something wrong with the methods. Let's take this cultivation and throw it in the bucket. That's it. But Fleming, in that case, he was curious. He was skeptical. He was just curious about what was going on in a relatively irrational way. And he went on to understand why in that particular cultivation the bacteria was actually dying. It turned out that it was because there were some mold growing up, and those mold were preventing actually the bacteria to grow, were actually making it die. And that was the beginning of the discovery of the penicillin. Fortunately, he didn't think rationally, okay, let's just throw it away, let's just not think about this, let's concentrate on the results that come up correct. He actually thought, okay, I have to investigate what is going on here. That was quite
because
irrational.
For the sake of understanding, so what is the peculiarity of this experiment is that normally in science, correct me if I'm wrong,
yeah,
Leonardo, so we have a very strict experimental setup, right?
Yeah.
So we just look at that in this specific case, this collection of cultivation of bacteria, and then, I mean, everything outside that is doesn't matter. I mean, it shouldn't matter.
Exactly.
But what Fleming did is actually try to look at, investigate the external, the thing that could not, were not belonging strictly to the experimental setup.
Exactly. It was just thinking outside of the box. The box is basically your recipe. I have to make the experiment. This is my recipe. My experiment has to be done like this, and it will lead to these results. And it has to be to lead to these results. This is how it should always happen. It almost never happens like that. But in that case, it was just curious. Said, okay, here there is something strange. I should consider what is going on here because it can be something interesting. It was about being open-minded, so to say, which is one of the main requirements for being creative, so to say.
Yeah, exactly. So in this regard, so is a scientist, can a scientist be linked or, I mean, associated with an artist or with someone who is crazy because he doesn't know where to go at the end, right?
It's interesting because if you give the description of the life of a scientist, it's more or less like this. A scientist is a person who invests years of his own life without a fantastic salary. I mean, decent, but not enormous. I mean, there are jobs that pay more, but we cannot complain. Years of his own life, his or her own life, usually four years, trying to make a few experiments because he has a certain inspiration about reaching a certain goal, a certain destination, and he doesn't even know whether his hypotheses are correct or not. He might end up 3-4 years later with a lot of work done and nothing is in his own hand. So basically he's walking like a blindfolded, guided only by passion and by, of course, the work of the scientist before this person. And this looks very much like the work of an artist in a certain way.
So basically, it's going towards a place that it doesn't really know whether it exists. It
doesn't know how to go there and whether it exists. I mean, and this crazy, is the, right? And this is actually the reality of science. I mean, it never happens in such a way that you have the script with the things that you need to do from the moment that you have the idea until the moment that you publish the paper, and you just have to follow them, and that will happen. This is the ideal situation, but it never happens like that.
Yeah.
Usually you start with an hypothesis and the data tells you something different. And that's what happens most of the time, actually. There are only fortunate cases in which your hypotheses are exactly correct at the very beginning. I mean, as Einstein was saying, if you were knowing exactly what you were doing at all the time, it wouldn't be called research.
Yes, exactly.
You are exploring something which is not known. You cannot read it on some books. And therefore, you might be wrong. And most of the time, you are.
But going back to the irrationality and to the creativity, do you think that if we're going to manage to build an ideal robot looking like us, it could manage to make those hypotheses, to make those educated guess, to have those insight, or is so the additional, like Gestalt would say, the sum of the part is not necessarily corresponding to the perception of an object.
I'm not a computer scientist. I'm definitely not the most appropriate person to answer to this, but I think that we're still quite distant from being able to build a computer or an algorithm which can actually think in such strange ways as the human do. I mean, maybe because sometimes inspiration comes from linking things which are so distant that I really cannot think about a way to teach a computer about making connections between such diverse things.
So, because this guess basically is not necessarily a collection of information.
Absolutely.
What it is?
We really don't know actually where it comes from. I mean, the inspiration for something can come from the most strange situation that have nothing to do with the work that you are doing. I cannot read. I mean, the history of science is full of these cases, but right now I cannot recollect actually not even one in this particular moment. But yeah, I mean, these things just come by themselves. I mean, we can talk right now about the insight, if you want. It's interesting because maybe of my background in philosophy, I always thought about the moment of devising a new idea in science as similar to what Immanuel Kant in the field of ethics was calling the moral feeling. It's interesting because according to Kant, the ethics was completely determined by the reason, but still the way in which people were actually not motivated, but inclined to act in a good or a bad way was coming out from something that they would call a moral sentiment, moral feeling. So it's interesting because there was this enormous amount of rational principles, which in the end let something that you can call feeling emerge. And it seems sometimes in science that it is like this. After years and years that you work on something, that you work on many different things, usually the inspiration for what can be the next direction to go comes out from a feeling that you cannot really explain. Sometimes you say, well, I think that this thing might work better. I cannot really explain why, but it just feels right to go into that direction. And many times it's also wrong, but sometimes it's not.
So it's like indeed. So you have a lot of information, a lot of the knowledge about what it should be, but probably, so like you were saying, like yeah. You have this feeling that probably so the educated guess has to go a bit over, so as
yeah.
to go something as to call, I mean, be an ensemble of all those information, but with something more, which
exactly.
only probably human have.
I mean that's what I think is more likely to be. It comes out of rationality, but it is strange to call it rationality anymore.
Yeah, exactly. It's a transformation.
It's a transformation. It's definitely a transformation.
So probably, I mean, a musician like you has as might have an insight from I don't know, music or, well, from dreams, for instance. Someone.
Yeah, of course. I mean, there is a famous story in the history of science about this famous chemist in the 19th century.
Ah, really?
Kekulé? Yeah, absolutely. who actually dreamt about the structure of the benzene. Benzene is a molecule in organic chemistry which is formed by six carbon and six hydrogen atoms. And he was trying to understand what could be the structure of this molecule that causes this particular properties. And apparently one night he dreamt about this snake that was biting his own tail with some atoms of carbon dancing around, carbon and hydrogen dancing around. He woke up, he noted it down immediately, and actually it turned out to be right. So, I mean, maybe that comes from all the work that he did before, maybe from all this experiment. But you cannot tell me that that's a rational construct.
Yeah, yeah.
A snake that bites his own... Yeah, absolutely. A snake that bites his own tail. The inspiration can really come from whatever.
Everywhere.
From everywhere.
Okay, so about the irrationality and inspiration. So I will now stop for a few minutes because we have Tom Waits here. Talking indeed about dreaming and oniric lyrics. So we have Tom Waits with Martha. Thank you, Tom Waits with Martha. So, going back to our main topic. So, is so we actually killed this myth of this very rational scientist, very boring, very nerdy, very. So now for Absolutely. Us is so hopefully the audience understood that it's passionate and Absolutely. Crazy and creative person. So this is about scientists. What about science? Is science still? Is science immobile or something else?
Of course not. Science is always a work in progress. It's continuously a work in progress, and we perfectly know that, especially in sciences which are not so-called exact sciences, like mathematics or theoretical physics, it's always about new experiments and, yeah, potentially discovering new things that we thought that previously that were working in different ways.
Your example, Renato.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that the most, from the field of neuroscience, neuroimaging at least, the most classical example that everybody can possibly follow is the fact of the localization of the functions in the brain. Because, I mean, believe it or not, but right now for us it's absolutely normal to think that our thoughts, our emotions, are in some way processed, elaborated, produced by the brain, but what stays inside our skull. It was not always like that. To go back to Aristotle, once again, Aristotle actually didn't think that the brain was the place where the thoughts were generated or perceptions. The brain, thanks to its nice convoluted shape, was actually the radiator of the body. I mean, it was used to cool down what was going on in other more important places to generate perceptions and thoughts, like the heart. I mean, the heart was thought to be the center of especially emotional expression, because of course when you're more angry, the heart beats faster. When you're more quiet, it beats slower, and so on and so forth. So the direct effect of the changing of the mood was immediately visible on the heart. But probably the most interesting part that I still remember from when I studied philosophy, because it's something that shocked me. I couldn't find the exact reference, but I'm pretty sure that I read it, is the place where actually the reflections and thoughts originated, according to Aristotle.
Where was that?
You would never guess it in a million years, because it was apparently the liver.
The liver?
Yes. Why the liver? Because think about reflections. In order to reflect, you need an organ which is nice and smooth and shiny. I mean, at that time, with the anatomical knowledge that was available at that time, and especially because of the paradigm of the Aristotelian science and blah, 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 it was perfectly fine to think that actually thoughts and reflections were originated in the liver. Of course, afterward, it changed a little bit. And maybe it's not nice to remember it, but actually most of the evidence that led us to think that actually behavior depends from what happens in the brain derived also from brain from wounds, especially war wounds. Of course, during wars, people unfortunately are injured in every part of the body and also in the brain. And it occurred to observe that when the wound was in actually the brain, there were some cognitive functions which are actually lost. So actually, yeah, in the last 300-400 years, maybe also a little bit more, actually, there is no doubt about the fact that some cognitive functions are localized in the brain, come out from the brain. And still, in a certain way, there is some debate between those who think that actually specific function is localized in a specific part of the brain, and those who think that actually functions, cognitive functions are generated by the interaction between different parts of the brain. And of course, there are reasons to accept one or the other idea according to different functions that you consider and so on and so forth. But actually, if I have to say, one of the great things that neuroimaging brought about is the ability to actually acknowledge that most of the cognitive functions, especially most complex, like, I don't know, entertain yourself at a party or demonstrating mathematical theorem, they require the interaction of a lot of different regions. So it is quite incorrect to think that there is a specific behavioral function localized in a specific brain region.
So then we start with Aristotle, thinking that the cognitive function were in the heart, and then probably the reflection, the thoughts in the liver. Then went on with the modularity of the brain, so that function were restricted to some region of the brain. Then we come up with this interaction among regions.
It is actually interesting because you know what? The first part of the 20th century was dominated by localizationism, so thinking that functions were strictly localized in a specific part of the brain because of historical reasons. In the 60s, there was some revolution, and people started to think, okay, besides the gray matter, there is also the white matter and connections, and therefore probably they are there for something. And then in the 70s, modularism came up, especially because of the book of Jerry Fodor, who was a philosopher, Modularity of the Mind. And this actually shows what happens when you let a philosopher tell the scientist how the brain works.
go back to philosophers then, eh?
Absolutely. No, by the way, they are great philosophers of the mind right now. But of course, in any case, the main point is that it's always a work in progress. And sometimes some new ideas, which are possibly more right and more correct to explain certain phenomena, are not readily adopted because science is also lazy. I mean, it takes a lot of time before paradigm change. Even though we think, and sometimes also some ways of thinking are more easy for us. Maybe we can think and have evidence about the fact that certain cognitive functions are generated by the interaction of different parts of the brain. But thinking about the fact that there is a specific region for remembering the my granny's pie.
It's easier, right?
It's easier, exactly.
So we should acknowledge the fact that indeed science is an evolutive, something in evolution.
Absolutely.
So, indeed. So, scientists know that, but they don't always apply it. They don't always implement it. That's true.
Sometimes it's difficult, indeed. I remember very, very quickly, I remember, for instance, when I started to study neuroscience, it was still thought that plasticity in the brain was limited mostly to the youth. Right now, we perfectly know that there is a lot of plasticity going on also in older age, and this happened, I mean, absolutely, 20 years ago.
Absolutely. So about plasticity, so we're gonna now put a very diverse or different song compared to the previous one. It's Jan Tiersen with Atlantic Nord, and then we're gonna end up with a surprise, exactly. So talking about how diverse is life of our great scientist Leonardo Cerliani, actually also a symbol
I am a human being.
It's also a symbol of how science can go a bit everywhere. So, but for now is Atlantic Nord of Jan Tiersen. How many things I got to know tonight with Leonardo? Because this song apparently was is belonging to the soundtrack of Tabarly, which is a documentary about this famous sailor.
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly.
So, but we only have 1 minute 40 seconds. So tell us about the, so what are you doing now? So what science brought you? So where did you go from neuroscience to? So surprise, surprise, guys.
Agriculture.
I would say that, as I call you on Facebook, the modern farmer.
it's not entirely true, but I'm still working in neuroimaging, but for quite some time, and still now, I started to work with some people in Finland, with Tiita Kotilainen and Matthew Robson, who are photobiologists. Basically, they study what happens in the interaction between light and plants. And I thought it was very interesting to try to do something completely outside of neuroscience. And it turns out that there are some things that also a neuroscientist can do in agriculture. So I started to do an application for them, which is now live on the internet. It's agrispectra.farm. And basically, yeah, after that, we are doing some other stuff. The other day, we were talking about, she was asking me, how can I actually control the light of the plants?
And I think we're going to talk about that next time, because we only have 20 seconds.
No
you
problem.
Will be our guest next time, I'm sure, because I got some message that a lot of people like you, actually. I got a message.
I like and, you too, guys.
So thank you, Leonardo, a lot.
Thank you
Radio
very
Italiana.
Much. Thank you very much. You've been so kind to me. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Radio Italiana, to having hosted us, and see you in 1 month.